Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Hey folks, welcome to the Fallon Forum. This is Ed Fallon with you. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway is Central Iowa's premier good food store and brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. If you're looking for quality foods with a community focus, check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses like Ritual Cafe. Contact Joe at 515-208-7312. Hey, a quick shout out to the Des Moines Irish Session. Thank you for providing our bumper music and good luck to all of us at the Iowa Irish Fest this coming weekend in Waterloo. Hey, before, Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Weiss, folks, a political prof at DMAC, and we're going to talk about whether America needs a divorce or simply marriage counseling. Jeffrey has a proposal he's been giving presentations on, and he's here to share that with you, and I'm here to rip it apart. maybe not. Okay. But anyway, before we talk about that, we got to talk about robots, okay? Just briefly, robots. Because now they're getting into food delivery. So in some parts of the U.S., they take Los Angeles, for example. Coco Robotics is now operating 1,000 street-level delivery robots, and they use the sidewalk, and I'm wondering whether that's legal for an electrical vehicle to move, use the sidewalk. But the company plans to open 10,000 units, so I'm wondering how do delivery workers feel about it. And in one story I read, Julia Ruggiero, she's a delivery worker. She says, quote, I used to make about 5 deliveries an hour. Now I'm lucky to get 3. I have to drive for Lyft just as, you know, in order to get by. So it's not just sidewalk robots. It's drones as well. Walmart apparently is using drones to deliver food in Atlanta and Charlotte. Where else? Houston, Orlando, Tampa. And it's not just here in the U.S. I got to share, before we talk, Jeffrey, I got to share a promotional clip from a AI company in Shenzhen, China. Check this out.
Across town, near a university campus, students gather around another delivery point. It's clear this isn't new to them. They already know where to go, how to scan, how to grab their order, and head to class. No waiting, no talking to anyone, no stress.
I love that. No talking to anyone, because, you know, talking to people is very stressful, Jeffrey, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, I don't know how stressful talking is, but we're going to start on
it. All I can
do
is just start singing Sticks, Mr. Roboto.
So, right, Mr. Roboto, sure. Yep. But, you know, on Reddit, there's a very fascinating post about shooting down drones. This is only in America would you hear I have this conversation. Discussion about what the best guns are for shooting down drones that are carrying food that just happen to stray across your property. Because that is your property, after all. And you have a right to shoot down anything above it.
Stand your
ground. Not really, you don't. But there are some people who seem to think you do. So, anyway, this all comes at a time when Trump is proposing, they got a plan, and I'll call it, called Winning the AI Race. And it's really taken a bite out of what states can do to regulate AI. And causing a lot of concerns among those who believe that there ought to be ways of managing the whole situation as we move forward into this very brave unknown world. Speaking of unknown worlds, Jeffrey, you have a proposal that I would love to discuss. You think it's time for America to have a divorce?
Yeah, I wrote an essay, Why the United States Needs a Divorce, in the spirit of Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, in the Declaration of Independence, wrote a right of revolution, in particular, if a form of government no longer works. And the United States is late for the party. What I mean by that is, and I've said this many times, that if you study presidential republics, they tend to be governments that end up becoming executive dictatorships.
How many do we have in the world right now? Just two, right?
There are, a number of presidential republics. There's probably, I don't know, I'm thinking 70 to 90
in
the world.
Many?
Yeah. The continent of Africa is populated with presidential republics. So is South America.
Where did my two figure come from? I thought there were two that were actually working well.
The two that work the best are Uruguay and Costa Rica.
Right.
And there are a number of presidential republics in South America that collapsed under military and executive dictatorship, Argentina, Brazil, et cetera, in the 70s and 80s. But unlike the United States, these countries have constitutions that can be changed, and they have allowed their governments, in fact, to, for example, introduce things like proportional representation voting in when they vote for their version of the House of Representatives. And unfortunately, the United States has a constitution that is nearly impossible to change. The other thing I would say just quickly, then I'll go for it. The United States is a country of 340 million people, and it is very diverse. And a presidential republic, especially one with plurality, winner-take-all voting, is just the worst form of government for a very diverse country. The United States has one more political party than China does. And what we have in many states, and we even have it in the national government right now, is a one-party state. Because checks and balances don't mean a lot if one party controls all three branches.
Right.
And so if you are in California and you are a member of the Republican Party, you're effectively disenfranchised. If you are in Iowa and you're a member of the Democratic Party, you're effectively disenfranchised. And if you live in the United States of America, where we have one party now that controls all three branches of government, and that one party is now authoritarian and has given up on the American experiment, you have a situation where, at least half of the population is, experiences some version of no taxation and no representation.
I don't think anybody would disagree with your analysis. There's probably some people who would, but I think for the most part, people understand that we are not functioning well. Maybe that's an understatement. Maybe people would say that we are actually dysfunctional. What is your solution?
What I thought about was to break up the country on either side of the Mississippi. 365-day transition, the presidential republic, everything would be completely dissolved. The two camps would be the only two camps I can think of that could at least be the people who would lead the people to a side of the Mississippi. The Republicans can lead a group to one side, the Democrats can lead a group to the other side. Now, of course, at least 40 to 50% of the population doesn't like either party. So that those people will need to decide who to follow. But because this current government will be dissolved, it will be up to the two factions on either side of the Mississippi to completely start from scratch. The borders will be secured, the river, whatever we need to do. But the reality is then the people sort of on the right in the United States can form whatever they want. I mean, if they want a Christian theocratic state, they can have it. If the people, more to the center or center left want to build something more like Norway, some kind of a social democracy, you have about 65 or 70% of Democratic base right now is considered to be sort of socialist or democratic socialist or wanting a social market economy. There's no way they can probably get to that in our current situation. So they could create something like that. And people would be able to live with the people that, to be honest with you, they always wanted to live with. I mean, if we're honest about the United States of America, we only have been a little bit of a democracy since 1965. That's not a long time. From 1789.
The Civil Rights Act.
Yeah,
the Voting Rights
exactly.
Act. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, and really, if we're honest about it, even now, we don't have one person, one vote. I mean, Jimmy Carter famously saying, you know, the Carter Center doesn't monitor United States national elections because the United States doesn't even fulfill the minimum requirements for being a democratic country.
So let me ask you this.
And I don't know what we do about that. We can't change the Electoral College. We can't change the undemocratic composition
of
the Senate.
I want to get back to that because I disagree with that. But let me, who gets the west half of the Mississippi? Who gets the east half?
I think just a simple coin flip would work. Somebody will end up with Florida. Somebody will end up with California. And, you know, in terms of thinking about this idea, there might be other ways to do it. I know some people have said when I've talked about it, they said maybe some north-south thing with no shooting, of course. And, I mean, this is going to be amicable. I mean, everybody can hug. They can shake hands. They can kiss each other on the cheek.
Amicable divorce.
Yeah, it'll be an amicable divorce.
Between 340 million people.
Absolutely. I think it's really the best way that that both peoples would have some kind of sort of life, liberty, in the pursuit of happiness. Because I feel as if when I look forward and I look at our form of government, our form of voting, corporations are people, money is speech. When I look at the very basic parameters for what both the so-called right and the so-called left agree with, getting money out of elections, et cetera, and you really don't see a way forward, then this would be a way where people could start from scratch and they could build whatever they want. And like I said, frankly, they can live with the people who they want to live with.
So who gets the east half of the country?
Like I said, a coin flip.
Okay, so if I'm either one of those two sides and I win the coin flip, I'm going to be on the west. And you know why? Upwind. So we'll get to send all of our toxins to the east, all of our wildfire smoke, all of the coal-fired power plants we build along the descending bank of the Mississippi River. All that smoke's going to go to the east side of the country. The eastern U.S., whatever you want to call it. And you'll have no recourse because we can do whatever we want. We're our own country now, and we know where the air flows. And also there's a bunch of water. I mean, what about the Missouri River? That flows in the Mississippi River. Well, we don't. What if we really don't care that we're going to be putting a lot of trash in there? I mean, how do you who's going to lose the flip and get the east side?
once again, I mean that all of these things can be worked out or not.
Well, yeah, is a big deal.
Yeah, after there's two separate countries. Maybe one country can sue the other in the world court over such matters that you're talking about. I mean, it does happen in international law where there are border disputes over water. There's border disputes over,
Well, we see how well border disputes are being resolved in Ukraine, Russia, Israel, Palestine, Cambodia, Thailand. To pick your. I mean, what 12? How many countries in Africa?
Yeah,
are some kind of war? It's not going very well.
But in fairness to many of those countries in Africa, they didn't draw their borders.
European.
Yeah, they were drawn artificially and in here, in my example, they're not drawn artificially. It's, both sides can agree on, these things. It might take a while, but, the general idea is that the country has reached an impasse and will be long dead. Our children will be long dead, and we will continue with Supreme Court justices for life. We'll continue with two parties in what will look like continually a one-party state. We will continue with money billionaires not only buying our elections but controlling our universities, controlling our media, controlling our information system. I mean, the Soviet Union had the Communist Party. We have a corporate oligarchy that operates in much the same way. So this is a way that we could start anew. And like I said, people could live with the people they want to live with in the first place.
What if I'm married? What if I'm a Democrat married to a Republican?
That's something that you'll need to figure out. You will need to figure that out.
You will have to make
the argument. You'll have to make the argument to your wife, or your significant other or whomever. But that's what will have to be figured out. You know, people will have to choose either side and go from there. I mean, I'm not saying that you know, mine is the only one. Maybe there's other people out there, and I'd like to hear from them too, that have ideas of maybe the way something like this could happen within states, you know, maybe some states to see it and things like that, because that's also a possibility.
Well, one more question before we run to a break here. So you said it will take 365 days to establish these two new republics.
Yeah. So and to disassemble everything else.
That's incredibly fast, by the way.
Yeah.
And so what triggers that decision? Who decides? Do you have a national vote? Is it a decision by some strong-arm president, for example? Or what's your mechanism for how that kicks off?
Well, I think I will be the strong-arm president.
Really? President Wise? We finally have a wise man president.
On behalf of this essay, I will certainly get the ball rolling. Okay. You know, and no, I mean, obviously, I think all your audience knows. I mean, a little or maybe a lot of this is tongue in cheek in terms of it actually happening, but I also would say that in terms of some people that I've spoken to about this, the discussion itself has drawn a conversation with people about really where we're going and what this is going to look like 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. And is there any way out of this, or are we going to live in illiberalism for the rest of our lives and for our children's lives? And I don't know the answer to that
question. Great moment for a break. Oh, I got to take a short break. I want to come back and pick up where we left off on that. That's a great question. Folks, I'm talking to Jeffrey Weiss, a political psi prof at DMAC, Des Moines Area Community College. Ed Fallon with you. We'll be back in a minute with more conversation on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses like Ritual Cafe in downtown Des Moines. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you, folks. Hey, thanks to our sponsors and partners, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, wherever you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. Contact daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com. Thanks also to the Catholic Peace Ministry, whose focus is on nuclear disarmament. The situation in Gaza and Palestine, the war in Ukraine, and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. All right, my guest this first half of the program, Jeffrey Weiss, and we've been talking about Jeffrey's proposal to dissolve the United States. He's calling it a divorce, to basically form two new republics, one on the west side of the Mississippi River, one on the east side of the Mississippi River. Basically, Republicans on one side, Democrats on another, independents go wherever they want to go. And before we dig into that, again, I have, just so you know, folks, I have some real problems with this. And Jeffrey knows that. But I think it generates some conversation we need to have. And one thing you brought up at the tail end of the last segment was, you know, the fact that we, you know, what is it going to look like in 10 years or 20 years? And there's so many factors involved. But just considering the political, you know, the political tension that exists and is likely, as has existed for a while and is likely to continue, you know, what do you think it looks like in 10 or 20 years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we'll just continue to live under illiberalism or semi-authoritarianism, where we have minimal freedoms, and we'll live like most people have lived in presidential republics. We don't have a form of government. We don't have a form of voting. And we don't have a constitution that can fix the problem we have. I as I say these words, I feel like I can hear Thomas Jefferson clapping, because whatever one wants to say about the founders of this country, they did understand that what they were writing was for 1789, and that there was a right of revolt and an obligation to change a government if it didn't work that was in the Constitution. And I can't imagine that many of those people would have thought that it's 2025 and we would be living under the same system.
So, I mean, a lot of people will blame Donald Trump for the drift into authoritarianism. Do you blame Donald Trump, or do you see that drift going back?
No, further? No. In fact, no, it's been going on for several decades. And really, the most significant differences in our country is really the outsized power that money has, and that big money has, in terms of buying politicians, in terms of writing our laws, in terms of the enforcement of our laws, in terms of, and so it is significant that one of our political parties is, when you do comparative government analysis, is somewhere in between the conservative parties in the UK and Canada and Erdogan's party or United Russia, that it has given up on the American
experiment.
You're
saying the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, it's anti-intellectual, it's anti-science, it's openly authoritarian in terms of endorsing political violence, in terms of not subscribing to one person, one vote, suppressing the vote, state after state.
Well, and
in fact, even publicly saying, in some, at least when they're honest, that, you know, maybe everybody shouldn't even have the right to vote, et cetera, you know. And I mean, and part of what I say with this proposal is, you know, really, we've reached a point in this country where, you know, one side says 2 + 2 = 4, the other side says 2 + 2 = 5. And, you know, at a certain point, you really don't want to argue with people that say 2 + 2 = 5. You just want to say, that's fine. But say 2 + 2 = 5 and live in that alternate universe somewhere else, you know, and I think really that's where we're at. Everybody's in their vacuums.
No matter where you live, I mean, we live in a neighborhood that is primarily Democratic,
mm-hmm.
but we've got a good friend in this neighborhood who voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
We get together for dinner sometimes. We get along just fine.
Sure.
We have another neighbor who has gone so far as to have a Trump sign, actually two Trump signs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not really comfortable to talk politics with them because it's basically just
sure.
just right-wing radio talking points. You know, there's nothing original coming out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a nice guy. Why would sure. I not want to have a nice guy as a neighbor, even if he disagrees on politics? Why does he have to move across the river?
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he would choose to live with you, or maybe he would choose to live with people like you. Maybe mm-hmm. if push came to shove and people had to decide where they were going to live, it could get interesting, to be honest with you. And, you know, there may be some Democrats or so-called Democrats or, you know, people in the center left, whatever, center who might go live on the other side. But I don't really think that is the issue. I mean, people can get along and work with one another in illiberal countries. Shoot, they could get along and live with each other in, you know, late 1930s, early 1940s Germany, and be neighbors. And
for a while.
Yeah.
To a point.
Yeah.
Depending on who you were.
Well, yeah. But I mean, once the bombs start dropping on Berlin, everybody sort of, you know, rallies around one another, no matter their background. You know, I don't think that is really the issue. I think from a larger macro perspective of a constitution that is nearly impossible to change, two-thirds House of Representatives, two-thirds of the Senate, three-quarters of the state.
That's not impossible. That's just difficult.
It's Well, it's happened 17 times.
Well, I know. It's already happened a lot.
Yeah, it can be vetoed. Well, it hasn't happened a lot.
How many amendments do we have?
17.
Yeah, okay, so that's a lot. And we repealed one of them.
Since 1789, the average life of a constitution is 17 years. You know, and one of the reasons ours has lasted forever is because it's, once again, it's impossible to change. I mean,
not impossible, just difficult.
Okay, 4% of the population has a veto over the, so 96% of the U.S. population based in states could agree on a constitutional amendment to, let's say, take money out of elections, and only 4%, the number of senators in small states, could veto it. Because when you're talking about 3/4 of the states, you know, understand that, and you know, I know you understand this, that some of these states are extremely small. So, you know, it's the same thing we have with the Senate.
Right. Why does Rhode Island have the same voting clout as Texas?
Absolutely. Yeah. And almost nobody around the world has a Senate that is set up as undemocratically, I mean, so far away from the idea. Part of what I'm saying is the best a presidential republic can do is majority rule and protect the minority. Mm-hmm. We have a form of government now in part because of the rural-urban divide. It's not the Republican Party's fault per se. They've just been able to capitalize on the fact that the Senate and the Electoral College give a dramatic advantage to small rural states.
Well, and then plenty of other, you know, election malfeasance as well. Gerrymandering, different laws for example, a silly law that you prevents you from handing out water or food to people waiting in long lines at polling places in Georgia. I mean, things like that. I mean, the election laws across the country are riddled with ridiculous prohibitive measures that make it difficult to vote. Why not fix all that? I mean, so let's argue. Let's say, Jeffrey, that the coin is flipped. Democrats get to move to California. Republicans get to move to the other side of the river. Not just California.
We'll start all over,
I guess, you know, Democrats get to move to Iowa on west. Mm-hmm. What does that migration look like? I mean, I think about the partition of India back in 1947. All the areas with a Muslim majority got to be Pakistan. There was East Pakistan and West Pakistan, and of mm-hmm. course, East Pakistan became Bangladesh.
Bangladesh, yeah.
But it was a horrible situation where people were uprooted from their homes, and millions of people would die. They were both Hindu and Muslim, died, murdered, children killed, fired. I mean, things torched. It was terrible. Yeah. Why would we not expect a similar?
This doesn't need to happen. Here? I mean, right now, when you look at opinion polls. You know, and this has been for a while, one of our parties has a more favorable view of, let's say, Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un than they do of, let's say, Hillary Clinton. So really, this does not need to be violent. And yes, you know, East Pakistan becoming Bangladesh, and we know that was very violent in the late 1940s. But over time, Bangladesh is Bangladesh, and India is India, and, you know, the two haven't been at war.
Pakistan is... Pakistan and India don't get along.
No, they don't.
And so here's what I'm thinking.
They both have nuclear weapons.
And both sides. Where do the nuclear weapons go?
That will all have to be worked out.
Right. So both sides are going to have nuclear weapons. It's going to be like India and Pakistan, with the Mississippi River, the dividing.
That will all have to be worked out. I mean, and I'm not saying that's a small thing to be worked out. It's I guess what I would say for people who don't think this makes sense. What is your solution for majority rule, for the reality that on the core issues of the day, both the Republican base and the Democratic base agree? And at the same time, there isn't a mechanism for those masses of the people to get what they want through normal constitutional procedures, through normal voting procedures. And whether you are Republican or Democrat in those bases, the public in the United States understands that money has extraordinary power, and corporations are people, money is speech. And if you can't have a constitutional amendment to change that, how does this all change? And I guess that's what I would pose to people. I think it's time to start anew.
I'll be your first respondent. Well, I'm probably not your first respondent, but I said, okay, so I advocate marriage counseling instead of a divorce. And in that counseling conversation, we talk about, well, what needs to change to make things functional. Instead of just, I mean, if it gets to the point where we can't figure out what to change, then yeah, we split up. But that's extreme. To me, figure out what to do with two separate countries, both that have nuclear weapons, one that's somehow Republican, one that's somehow Democrat. I don't know how that works without a civil war that's going to make the previous civil war look like a walk in the park. So to me, it's a lot easier to change the U.S. Senate, do away with the U.S., maybe not do away with it, but make it proportional, you know, based on vote, like the House. The House is based on population. Make the Senate based on population as well. Do away with, I mean, put some big checks and balances on money in politics.
Okay.
Do away with Citizens United.
Okay.
Instant runoff voting. You know, some of these reforms.
Yeah.
You know, so
as long as you can persuade the two parties and the corporations that give money to the two parties.
That control them.
To have a two-thirds vote in the Senate, a two-thirds vote in the House, and three-quarters of the state to ratify it, it's not going to happen. I mean, all of the ideas that you're talking about are a lot of times in the back of political science books for like what we do now. And those things have a likelihood of, I don't know, 1 in 10,500. I mean, what are your odds? So this is the only way that I can see, at least in a thought experiment, in other words, the polarization is too great right now, and the institutions that we have cannot solve the conflict that we have the way it is currently set up. I mean, if you were to ask probably almost anybody in the United States, how would you like to have proportional representation voting, multiple parties, you get 10% of the vote, you get 10% of the seats, I think almost everybody would agree with you. But both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party don't want that.
I have seen that. When I offered common sense election reforms at the state level as a lawmaker, I had a Republican that agreed to sponsor amendments with me. And I had the ranking member, the leading party member of the state government committee, both parties, Democrat, Republican, shot it down.
Yeah.
You know,
And
we got a handful of votes, but not much. So I know what you're saying.
Oh, yeah, because the two parties, you know, in part benefit from this. You know, they can have a monopoly if they're in California, and then, you know, the other party has a monopoly if they're in Iowa. And so we are staring at a one-party state at a national level, and I think we'll be probably doing that for a long time.
No. Really? You don't think Democrats are going to gain the House back in 2026?
It won't matter, because with the filibuster, any substantive legislation...
Filibuster in the House. You're talking about the Senate.
The filibuster in the Senate, because any substantive legislation that would be passed in the House will be filibustered in the Senate.
But
even if the Democrats control the Senate, you need 60 votes in the Senate.
But a Democratic Senate is going to block a bunch of stuff.
Another veto.
Right?
What's that?
A Democratic House, rather, could block a lot of stuff from happening.
A few things.
Okay.
They can do oversight, and they'll do a lot of oversight is mostly what they'll do. But in the end, even if the Democrats were to take the House and the Senate, the minority party would filibuster nearly everything. The only thing they couldn't filibuster is some budget bills and some cabinet appointments and you know.
So,
but anything substantial, you know, related to other things, it'll just be filibustered. Filibuster is just another one of those mechanisms that most countries don't have. It's fundamentally anti-democratic, there doesn't seem to be a way to let it go.
I think there is. Is universal agreement, not universal, but overwhelming agreement that things need to change. And part of the problem is these reforms don't get prioritized in elections. And so you have, they end up getting ignored. And the partisan, the special interests that control the parties don't want to see them addressed. But anyway, Jeffrey, we could talk about this for a long time. You and I ought to have a public debate on this. We ought to sell tickets.
Yeah.
If
nothing else, and I think your audience can tell that, I mean, it's a thought piece. It's just to get us thinking, and in the Jeffersonian tradition.
Yeah. Well, Thomas Jefferson, if he was here today, you'd think he'd be clapping for you. I think he'd be stopping his foot. No, maybe not.
I think he'd probably look at us both like we're both crazy.
Maybe that. Yeah. Hey, I got to run to a break, folks. When we come back. We'll be talking with Zach Kucher and John Norris about a couple ag and water-related issues affecting central Iowa and maybe other parts of the country as well. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Westrom Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrom and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry. Thanks also to Ritual Cafe. Ritual is known for its fair trade coffee and fair trade tea. The cafe serves breakfast and lunch and an entirely vegetarian menu. Ritual Cafe is located on 13th Street between Grand and Locust in downtown Des Moines. Hey, I'd like to welcome Zach Kucher to the program. He's co-founder of the LSI Global Greens Initiative, and he's also a board member of the Sustainable Iowa Land Trust. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ed.
Tough times for small farmers, given some of the changes that are coming through the federal government at the instigation of the Trump administration. But you've noticed that how these cuts are going to affect the regional food business centers. With I guess there are 12 around the country. The nearest one to Iowa is in Missouri, and it's having a big potentially having a big impact on a lot of small growers.
Yeah, I mean, we were lucky to be part of the initiative to help develop small farm businesses through technical assistance and education. Another one of the important aspects of the regional food business centers was their mini grant program that was a pretty low barrier that any farmer could apply to increase their value-added production and help get grants to increase the amount of money they're making, distributing food, growing food. And so we've where I work at LSI, we were part of that to be able to provide assistance to farmers to fill those out and to do education. And it's going to...
So how many... is this going to put some farmers out of business or just decrease their ability to operate in a profit?
I mean, that's a tricky question because historically there weren't a lot of programs for small farmers at all. And it was a really nice change, actually, to have programs. So in a lot of ways, what we do, like during COVID... people were like, what's this going to mean? We're like, well, we're going to keep growing food. And I want that to be clear that no matter what happens, like, we're going to keep growing food no matter what.
Because we're going to keep eating no matter what.
That's right.
It seems to be a problem.
That's right. I mean, yeah. We're out there every day in the fields. It's 100 degrees. I was out there earlier at a couple farms.
110 today.
Is it 110?
The heat index.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah, got to take breaks in the shade.
So you mentioned in a post you put up on Facebook about this that these cuts come at a time when we see a continuation of subsidies from the taxpayers through the federal government for big farms. What exactly were you referring to there?
There's programs that commodity farms, corn, bean producers can still get. They have a good safety net that continues, and those are programs that have been going on for a long time. I guess right now I don't anticipate seeing cuts to that. I don't have a crystal ball either, but
right. I do, but it's in the trunk.
Oh, you should go get that, man. I think that really help us make, you know, we make crop plans, but we can't, it's hard to make financial plans when you're like, I'm going to apply to a grant for $50,000 to help me buy a box truck where I can distribute this food and make money.
It's hard enough in farming to deal with the weather, you know, and then you got to deal with a fickle federal government.
Right.
That seems to be changing its tune depending on which administration comes along.
Yeah, and I've been open-minded, and I try to be open-minded, and I have friends and family who support Trump, like we all do. We're in Iowa, and I think it's important to understand where people are coming from. Now, like when I saw the USDA's farm policy come out that Rollins put out, small farmers, family farmers, local foods.
Great rhetoric.
And then the Make America Healthy Again. Like, this is great. Like, rhetoric. Let's get more vegetables and things like this. But then the programs, like, that we've worked on developing and implementing that are actually putting money, that are developing these things, they're giving some of these large farmers, too, or family farmers, to me, if they have 500 acres, that's a lot of acres. But those farms are also at risk these days because of not having choices to grow.
So do you think, I think across the board, farmers are going to be hit by some of these, it's by one action or another coming from the federal government, whether it's cuts to this kind of program or the tariffs, which who knows where that's going to go. But are you hearing from farmers across the board? I mean, you deal mostly with small farmers, but still, I mean, maybe you're hearing from other farmers too as to whether they're satisfied with the direction this administration is taking farm policy.
I guess what I heard too is, in general, a lot of the programs that have been recently implemented that were getting more money to the small growers, even mid-sized growers, growing things that are not just corn and beans or not just being burned for ethanol or not just supporting large animal feeding operations and things like that. And I guess like the local food purchasing assistance got cut too, which that was a really great program that was paying food banks and other entities to buy food. And there are farmers who were diversifying their crops.
Right.
I just heard from somebody that program, same one that we had in Iowa, got cut in New York, and it's having huge effects on farmers.
So the kind of the bottom line question is, who is behind these policy changes?
It's,
who wants this?
I'm not sure because some of the rhetoric.
Do I need to go get my crystal ball?
I don't like being too political, Ed. And like, I guess I just want to support farmers doing what they do.
Right,
and really, like, the important thing is that. And we're doing this on a local level. And, you know, I mean, the amount that you've gone through to help change the laws around here so we can just grow in our yards and to have chickens in our backyards. Like, I don't understand why we're just being, like, assaulted on all levels. And these federal programs were really great. And they were helping to develop the economy. These are things, like, we just need to get behind.
Well, am I out of line to suggest that the big farm corporations, especially, you know, the big processors as well as the big producers, don't want the competition that's coming from small growers or from diversifying the capacity to raise food in the city, for example?
You'd think that as big as some of those companies are, they wouldn't need to also make all the policies be in their favor and push everybody else out too. Actually compete on a level playing field. Yeah. And
wouldn't it be great to get to a level playing field?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I feel like it's an uphill battle to do this, and we're just trying to grow food. And I mean, I don't like getting involved in all this, but when the policies are coming out and money's getting cut that was going into farmers' pockets, I have to say something.
Well, your reticence to being involved with this sort of thing, you just want to farm, I get that, and that's one reason I really appreciate you taking the time to come talk with us today. So again, I really, really thank you for coming and joining us, Zach Kutcher, folks, and keep an eye on what's happening with local farms and see how they fare in some of the changing environments of farm policy.
Yeah, and make sure you come out to Global Greens Farmers Market, 1907 Carpenter, Saturday mornings. I got to put a pitch for that. We have the Double Up Food Bucks program.
That's so for the Des Moines people.
Yeah, for Des Moines people, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, make sure you guys are all supporting local wherever you're at. And your food dollars really do matter, so support local wherever you're at.
Thanks for joining us, Zach.
Thanks, Ed.
My next guest is John Norris. John is the former Polk County Administrator here in Central Iowa. He was also the chair of the Iowa Utilities Commission back when it was the Iowa Utilities Board. He also was a chief of staff for Congressman Leonard Boswell. And way back when I first met him, he ran Jesse Jackson's campaign for president in 1988. That's how far back we go, John.
It's quite a ways.
Yeah, welcome to the program.
You're aging us already.
Well, we're aging together. So what we've talked on this program before about water quality, and it's an issue, you know, across the country, of course, but here in Iowa, it is a problem. I mean, the high nitrate levels that have resulted in a ban on use of water for watering lawns, for example, and it led to the research that went into the Central Iowa Source Water Research Assessment, which you were instrumental in pushing forward in the county. And that assessment has a lot of clout behind it, and I think a lot of potential to begin to change the conversation on what we do to clean up our water.
Yeah, and you mentioned no lawn watering. If someone said no lawn watering, you think it because there's not enough water.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
The problem was there was tons of water.
Yeah. But too much.
Yeah, and they couldn't mix it down to get the nitrates below 10 milligrams. That's the real story here, I think, why I've been engaged in the water issue for so many years is we have this incredible, abundant natural resource, but it is being poisoned, mm-hmm. literally.
Who's poisoning it?
Well, as the report says, no surprise, but we had 16 PhD, well-respected scientists from both Iowa and across the U.S., did the most comprehensive assembly of research. Over 4,400 hours went into this report.
Hmm. How much did it cost?
Just a little over $1 million.
Okay.
I guess maybe 1.2.
But I mean,
it's been going on for 3 years.
Okay.
And really, with the directive I've gave them was, we want to know what's in our water, where does it come from, and what do we do about it. Hmm.
And we know what's in it.
We do.
A lot of nitrates and some PFAS as well, I believe.
Yep. Nitrates, PFAS, E. coli, microcystin.
And most of that, just to be sure, people know this, because the Central Iowa Water System services about, 20% of the population of the state.
That's right.
And those things get removed for the most part.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, even the nitrates aren't gone completely, but they're well below the EPA threshold. But the equipment needed to keep pace with the need to remove that water is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I get it, and that's one question I hear all the time. Well, is it really okay to drink it? I mean, I know more and more people talking about getting reverse osmosis systems because they aren't convinced that the water is okay.
Just the Des Moines Water Works does a tremendous job to keep our water under that 10 milligram limit. But the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers is what we studied. Those two watersheds form the most of the water supply for Central Iowa, and they do consistently keep it under that 10 milligram limit. Now, there are a lot of people who think that it should be 5, and EPA has
talked
about
I've heard even
3. Yeah, and
some,
even
some
3.
Saying 3.
And obviously, there's a lot of concern about the link to cancer rates across
sure.
Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
So the baseline is we know it has to be under 10. It's probably better if it's less. But we have the most expensive nitrate removal system in the world in Des Moines.
So we know what's in it. Do
right.
we know how it's getting in?
Yes. So the report is definitive. I mean, what I wanted were 16 scientists that had no bias. We gave them no instructions of what we wanted the outcome to be, other than just solidly backed facts and science that we can rely upon that can guide public policy.
Mm-hmm.
Their conclusion was that it's about 80% attributable to our agricultural practices.
80%. And the other 20%?
A mix of wastewater from municipal
cities,
systems,
okay.
Runoff. Dr. Helmers from Iowa State did a study 5 years ago that he concluded that there's about 25 million acres in cropland in Iowa,
mm-hmm.
and about 1 million acres of city and urban areas mm-hmm. Of land. That the runoff from the urban areas, the non-agricultural acres, mm-hmm. is about 9 million pounds of nitrates.
So about 20%.
No, the ag system produces 670 million
okay,
pounds.
Okay, wow, all right, yeah.
Yeah, it's less than 3% of the runoff of just nitrates. But
so you've got a meeting coming up, to a very high-profile meeting, I think, that involves our former Senator Tom Harkin, who is a great friend of agriculture, but also a great advocate for clean water and the environment. And that that meeting is intended to try to help the public better understand what the report is proposing.
Yes, yes. So next Monday, 6 o'clock.
August 4th, okay.
Yep. At the Cheslow Auditorium at Drake University. We originally had it scheduled for the Harkin Institute conference room, but we've grown.
Oh, too big of a crowd.
Way too many people.
Good problem.
Which is great.
Yeah.
And this will be the first presentation.
Okay.
Some of the scientists will be there. Jen Terry, who led the study.
She was working with Waterworks.
We hired her from Des Moines Waterworks
to work for
Polk County to put this whole study together. And it'll be the first public presentation of the entire report with scientists in attendance for people to hear, see, ask questions. My intention for this is that we'll be recording it as well, make it available to anyone in the state that wants to show this to their local community. Where we can, we'll send out myself or Jen or other speakers that people would like to have talk about the report. Because the ultimate goal here for me with this is a better informed public means more people running for office will be questioned about do they support measures to clean the water up.
Water quality might actually be an issue in campaigns.
That's what I think this report really enables us to do, is to better inform the public. It's alarming, right?
Right.
And push back against all the corporate ag interests that have tried to tell us, we're addressing it with all these voluntary measures.
Yeah.
Well, we've been doing the voluntary measures for 12 years, and it's actually gotten worse.
It's getting worse, yeah. Well, John, I really like to have you back on the program after this first and then subsequent meetings, just to kind of get a sense of the public pulse on it, and also to get a sense of what kind of opposition is brewing to it. Because, again, there are farmers doing great stuff, good work on conservation, good work on water management. There are plenty of farmers who don't. And, again, the voluntary system, as you said, 12 years of that, not working very well. So let's see how this plays out over the next couple of months, and have you back on to give us an update on how it's progressing.
Yeah, certainly. And the key here is water testing.
Yeah.
They're trying to tell us they're doing all this stuff, spending all this money. Mm. That doesn't matter if the water is not getting better.
Okay. Yeah. John, thank you so much for joining us, folks. We've been talking with John Norris. When I come back from a short break, Kathy Burns is going to be on the program with me. You know Kathy. We're going to be talking about America's protein obsession. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic. Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. Well, Kathy, welcome to the program.
Howdy.
And we're talking protein today.
Well, there's a weird thing going on in the U.S.
It's been going on a while.
It has been. It was a slow simmer, and now it's a full boil. everybody is trying to cram as much protein into their bodies as they can because whatever, a number of reasons. But
not everybody, but a lot of people. There's a lot of advertising and
conversation
about doing that.
It's being touted as the best way to gain muscle and lose weight. And there are certainly people who are focusing on that for their health, which is great. But the gurus on Instagram, TikTok, and other platforms, they've just mesmerized viewers with promoting these so-called benefits of high-protein diets. And they have testimonials with people telling their stories about getting back the bodies of their teenage years by by mega dosing on the protein.
When you say mega dosing, they're not eating lots of meat necessarily or eating lots of eggs. They're taking supplements or both?
A supplement would be in the form of a powder, something like that. So people aren't really always checking the amount of protein that they need in a day. If you work out more, you might need some more protein. It varies. But according to the scientists, we need about 2.76 grams of protein for every 3 pounds of body weight. And it varies slightly depending on your age.
That's a lot of math.
Yeah, I did.
What's it come out for you?
Well, for me, it comes out to... I'm 63 years old. I weigh about 130 pounds, so I need about 47 grams per day. And that's, here's the equivalent of that. That's 8 eggs.
Okay.
You wouldn't want to eat all eight eggs. Not all in one. 5 cups of yogurt will give you that 47 grams.
That's over a quart.
Yeah. 2.5 cups of whole almonds. 3 cups of cooked black beans. You don't want to eat
three cups of cooked black beans. You would be totally unsociable.
To get your full amount of protein per day. 6 ounces of chicken will give you all the protein you need for a day.
So meat is a much more condensed source.
4 ounces of steak. So those are some ideas. So you could mix and match all of that. And I tried to get, different types
of
foods.
So a 4-ounce steak and then a bunch of salads and you have your...
You're
maxed out.
Yes.
Now.
Yes.
If you're eating a 12 ounce steak, you may be
overdoing it. Ed, you'd need about 60 grams of protein per day. But here's the thing. The New York Times calculator, article also said, quote, most adults meet or exceed, and they're talking about adults in the U.S., meet or exceed their recommended amount, but some do not, including an estimated 10 to 25% of women up to age 70 and 10 to 25% of men over 50. But a New York Times reporter who has a PhD in nutrition also says that women in the U.S. typically consume about 35% more protein than needed daily, and men are exceeding the recommended protein intake by 55%. So this to me speaks of disparity.
Right. So why is it a problem?
To eat a lot of too much protein, your poor little kidneys can only take out so much waste per day, and protein puts a lot of waste into your system. Once your body takes the protein it needs from a food product, it has more waste to get rid of, and the harder your kidneys work, the faster they will wear out. That's an unusual thing about that.
So I'm curious. Dietary fads, preferences, changes have a comparable impact on agriculture. How does How does this protein craze affect farming?
The dairy industry is loving it because whey, a byproduct of butter making cream and other milk products, ice cream, etc. It is the key ingredient in a whey powder, of course, a protein powder. That's kind of the favorite, the darling of the protein world.
That could be a nice separate conversation sometime. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more to it.
Hey, thanks, Kathy, and thanks to our guests today, Jeffrey Weiss, Zach Kuchar, and John Norris. Thanks also to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, Kathy, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, real estate agent Joe Henry, Ritual Cafe, and Architecture by Synthesis. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. We will be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.